You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer. All lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home.
Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch.
The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed.
And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Broken records, the albums you wouldn't shut up about. Broken records, the music our guests can't live without.
Like Judy,
Barbara,
Liza,
Bette,
Betty,
Audra,
Bernadette.
We broadcast this podcast with hopes that someday we might get Patti LuPone.
Welcome to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. I'm Ben Rimmelauer, and I'm here with my lovely co-host, Daniel Nolan.
Hey, y'all. Today's guest is Tony-nominated playwright, and actor Charles Bush.
Charles Bush rose to fame in the 1980s as the author and star of a number of long-running off-Broadway camp sensations, including the legendary Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
His acclaimed Broadway play, The Tale of the Allergist Wife, ran for over 2 years, originally starring Linda Lavin, Michelle Lee, and Tony Roberts.
Charles also starred on screen in the movie versions of his plays Die Mommy Die and Psycho Beach Party, both screenplays by him.
Mm. Most recently, Charles starred off-Broadway in the world premiere of his new play, The Confession of Lily Dare.
The critics raved, I raved, Bette Midler was there the night I saw it, she loved it too.
Speaking of not Bette, Charles is coming in to chat with us about Yentl.
Oh, tell me where is it written what it is I'm meant to be, that I can dare.
Yes. Two syllables, baby. Cut to me driving around in my parents' suburban summer of 2012, the summer before I moved here, driving back and forth to Oklahoma City for this design internship, blasting that song on repeat the whole way.
Tales all this time.
And then renting Yentl. What does she say in the concert? She's like, to know the rest of the story, you'll have to go rent the videotape. whenever she's doing her little, like, Barbara plot summary bullshit banter. Anyway, I rented Yentl and, you know, took the full journey, which
how do we feel
wasn't quite sure I wanted
Yentl
to take. Okay, here's my take on Yentl, is that as a director, I feel like it's good. I mean, it's beautifully photographed. It's, you know, I think as a director, she did a really great job. And she sounds amazing, you know, as we said with Charles, she's never sounded better vocally, but, well, except, like, in the 60s and 70s. But,
and the rest of the 80s.
But, but, you know, I don't love Yentl. Mm-hmm. I have to be honest and speak my truth, because every number, it's, you know, it's kind of, besides, like, Papa, Can You Hear Me, and, the end song,
Piece of Sky,
where she kind of, you know,
so melts.
It's, yeah, but it's kind of like, it's weird because, like, nobody else seems to notice she's singing on this boat. Even
well, that's
though,
the whole movie.
Right. But all the other
I
songs
mean, it's
are
very
like,
appropriate for, like, quarantine times because totally. She's starting in a musical all by herself.
All by herself. But, like, that's the thing. It's, like, all the songs are,
like,
her.
Imagine how hard it was to keep it from Mandy Patinkin on set that it was
right.
a musical.
Right?
I was thinking, why couldn't it be, Papa, Can You Hear Us?
She's like,
So you go, tell me where, and I go, tell me where.
But, you know, every song is like,
Papa!
It's like,
watch me!
Fly. Yeah, exactly. But every song is like this weird recitative, and it's like her in her mind.
Those fighting words.
Like, it's like, it's not really that exciting.
I mean, are you not a Michelle Legrand fan? Fan? Not fan.
No, no, it's not. It's, the music is wonderful, but it's just the way it serves the plot, I guess, like the plot device of it being her, like, internal fantasy or whatever, which, I mean, it kind of works for things like Chicago because it's, you know, it becomes this huge production number with showgirls and
well, those are fantasies of action.
Exactly.
This
exactly.
is just her, like, therapy session.
It's, like, literally just her thinking about it. So it's not that exciting. One, two, I could allow, but it's, like, the whole movie is that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's no real, like, tension because it's just her thinking these things. So it's not really, like, there's nothing really at stake in the numbers for me. So
right. So you would actually like the movie better without the songs?
Yes, 100%. Or maybe just, like,
not at all.
The first and second.
Without the songs, the first or and the last dialogue. Song.
And also, you know,
Papa Can You Hear Me is the first song.
Papa Can You Hear Me, and then,
But what about my favorite song? What's it called? There are moments, you know. What's the song
in the woods?
You know, the one that's like, I can walk through rooms where there are rooms within rooms that have always been a part of me. There are certain things that once you have, no man can take away.
Yes, this is one of those moments.
No way. I just like that part of my voice. No tide can turn away.
That sounds good.
Thank you.
I love that song too. And I love a lot of these songs. I just think, you know, listening to them is great, but then when you see
that song
movie,
is not well. But you know what song is very weird. Active is Tomorrow Night.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
Although it is a little weird too that she's belting and nobody notices.
She's belting.
She's like trying on that like tallis or whatever.
And is that the one that's like intercut with a lot of the dialogue? It's like
no, or is that the one like the one where like a pot roast, whether to roast or to not roast, something that rhymes with pot roast.
And then,
where there's randomly comedy shows.
No wonder. Is that, and then, no wonder part.
Potatoes.
No wonder part two.
Potato. All right, that's the problem. There's fucking no wonder part 75.
Yeah, no wonder part two, though, is like the most Streisand lyrics ever because she talks about, blah, 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 blah. Who cares when the food's so delicious, not to mention these beautiful dishes? Just like Barbara now.
Somehow, like, a note to self in her, like journal
right,
about the show.
Right,
and
right.
The show. In the actual film.
Film. But, you know, and her performance is fine, but I don't believe for a second that she would pass as a man, you know?
I thought you were going to say as a human being.
Well, that too, but as a...
I mean,
as a student.
Yeah, it's weird that they didn't do better on that.
Yeah, I'm like, she really does not pass as a man, and I mean, no, like, no 5 o'clock shadow, no, I mean, her face is just so feminine, you know, and her voice is so feminine, I don't know. I mean,
is that why people
it.
Dog the movie? Well, one of the reasons they dog the movie,
yeah.
Like, is there a sense that, like, she's too vain to, like, make herself look like her?
Although,
really,
you know,
like,
famously, all the Anschulz parts she filmed from her bad side. Because
which begs the question, Barbara has a good side.
You know, so, like, that was probably very difficult for her to do. But, I don't know. I just think, you know, it's like watching, a Mozart opera where
the music sucks.
Where the music sucks. No. But, like, you know, in all those operas, it's like men disguising themselves from their fiancés
right.
to see if they'll cheat on
sure.
them.
But
it's
like an opera.
Yeah, but it's like in an opera, you're like, okay, obviously.
Right, but like a film from the 80s,
yeah,
you would
or
think
like,
that like they could have like just like done a really good job.
Yeah, it's like no one is going to believe that. I mean, in an I Love Lucy episode, it works because she's wearing like a mustache and like Ricky is not supposed to recognize
her. So
wait,
was this her choice or was it that she was too egotistical and wouldn't listen to anybody?
Well,
like, is that one of Spielberg's notes from when she showed him the dailies and she was like, as a man, he doesn't want to let me be a director.
I feel like on Yentl, she probably wasn't getting a lot of, like, pushback. Like, people weren't giving her their ideas. You know, she was running the show.
As opposed to when she was directing Funny Girl and she had to listen to people's opinions.
She had to listen to William Wyler, is that his name?
The actual director,
yeah. I mean, I feel like Yentl, the reason she has such good fond memories of it is because, like,
she was alone.
No one was giving her any feedback, you know? It was like, she was running that ship.
It had to be that way on Prince of Tides, too. Although you imagine that Nick Nolte must have mouthed off to her more than Mandy.
100%. Batigan. And we've heard the stories of that, like, her trying to hold, you know, work late into the night, and people were like,
although
no,
you know that
over.
The Nora Ephron movie, what's the one with Jack Nicholson and Meryl Streep?
Heartburn?
Yeah, was originally Mandy Patinkin, and he got fired.
Wow.
And Jack Nicholson was the replacement.
I mean, I have heard, you know, Mandy's no walk in the park, but...
Yeah, so I'm surprised that he and
I'm surprised, too. That is shocking.
Maybe he was chastened. Or do we pronounce it?
Chastened. But, you know, there's
could that be a new meme? Like, ooh, girl, you just got chastened.
You should try that. You should make that.
That's going to be my new persona. Someone that says,
your new
ooh,
brand.
Girl.
You just go, ooh, girl. Yeah, we need that. I really think we need that from you. But I feel like on Yentl, you know, she always tells that story about, like, that letter that they wrote in the press, that they released to the press, wherever the fuck they filmed that. About how, you know, the crew wrote this article about how, or this letter about how the rumors you hear about Barbara aren't true. Like, it was a joy to work with her. It was collaborative. It was wonderful, you know, and that she's like, that was, you know, that's one of my, you know, most prized possessions.
Oh, sure it is. Right up there with that velvet pillow that she keeps on the couch in the other grandma's house.
I can't with grandma's house.
Oh my God. I mean, I sound like I'm dogging. I actually really, like, love Yentl. I mean, I don't think it's, like, a great film, but, like, I can sit through it. I love the album. I mean, I guess I like it best as a Barbara Streisand album.
Yes. Yes, that's a good point.
Like, that's I love that song that this is one of those moments. I really, yeah, like, to totally. Me, that's one of my, like, workout jams. Yeah. Like, there are certain things that once you have, no.
Yes. And what's the one I was listening to it this morning, and I was, exactly what you're saying, I was like, wow, like, I haven't really taken the journey with Yentl as an album.
Yeah.
And there are some really, really beautiful songs.
Like, I mean, I love her singing that Michelle Legrand stuff.
No matter what happens,
me,
is another wonderful one.
The worst thing about the Yentl album is the dialogue.
Oh, it's
now you want to make it like a legitimate musical comedy? Like, when I finally have the CD alone and, like, nobody here to bug me, I can just listen.
It is insufferable. I mean, it's
hearing that's, like, polite.
Yeah, I mean, it's
some
painful.
Bullshit.
It's painful hearing those.
The only thing worse than that are the dialogue intros on Partners.
Truly. Honey, you have to work late again? All right.
I don't iron his clothes.
I don't
iron. Well, I actually don't iron.
I actually don't iron. I haven't ironed since I grew up my nails back in 1968. And my nails are real, by the way.
Anyway.
I never...
What song was I singing?
Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. It's so wonderful to be here at the Gay Games. Remember that article? No, it wasn't an article. It was a weird... Oh, God. I wish I could look it up right now on Insta. But she released this, like, weird video montage of her nails over the years.
Oh, my God.
And it was like...
This cannot be
just
true.
Setting the record straight. My nails are real and always have been. And it was like this, literally like this, like Ken Burns, like minute long documentary of her nails over the years. And I was like, kind of grossed me out. I was like, yeah, like those are real, but they're so fucking long. Like, I almost wish they were fake because, like, having a nail that long kind of grosses me out. Especially in the age of coronavirus.
Yes,
like, baby,
especially.
Keep those clean.
I also have to say, like, the nails are the part of Barbara Streisand that I care for the least.
Yeah, I don't...
Like, I think of her as, like, she's so iconic and I love her so much. But, like, I would not have any less love for her if she just had human, normal nails on the
side. Yeah, totally,
like,
totally.
Like, I don't... But... Like, I love that she... Like, I would like to know... What percentage of her fabulousness she thinks comes from her nails versus, like,
well,
what it is.
Well, I mean, if we really want to get into it, there's so much of... I mean, this is... I hope Dublin Zoetrope is loving every minute of this, because this we're really going in deep. And you know, I will say, as much as I worship Barbara and I love her, like, there's so much of her that I find completely, whether it's
what's that line from The Office where Michael's talking to Toby and he's like, there's so much about you that I hate. It's like, I just hate so much of what you are.
Yeah. No, I'm thinking of the Stanley bit where he's like, Michael, your style, your methods, everything you do, I would do differently. Anyway, goodbye. Stanley is truly the one I identify with the most. But anyway, it's not about The Office. This is about Barbara. But, you know, I feel like as she got money and got famous, it's like, the thing with someone who is so obsessive and so controlling is like, when you don't have money, you can't really, you know, go all out and like and entertain those notions. But once Barbara got money, you know, she started buying the Tiffany lamps. She started, you know, her original white dog that, you know, that birthed an entire lineage of white dogs.
The great grandself of the dog she still has.
Sadie, I think, was the first one. But it's like the nails came out. You know, it's just this idea of
wasn't
being
the
like
whole thing that she always had the
class.
Nails, even when she was struggling, so that she would never become a secretary.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, and so it's and then you know the hot water bottle story, and now she's obsessed and hoards all these dolls, and it's just this idea of like her rejecting her, you know, poor scrappy upbringing. Completely, to the extent where now it's like, you know, the nails have become such a part of her identity. Not, you know, it's almost more of like a, it's symbolic. It's like, it's her becoming like the rich white woman that she always wanted to be.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what is, that's the biggest turnoff with Barbara.
Right. And, you know...
I mean, that's true of a lot of our divas, you know? I mean,
right, and
that some of the stuff I've said about Bette, the sides of Bette that I have liked less,
mm-hmm.
were the version of her that was, you know, not warm to Kathy Griffin, or, like, the way she was in I'll Eat You Last, you know?
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, the scrappier, you know?
Beth
and,
House
you know, or if you even talk about Madonna, you know, I like Madonna... the, like, East Village, like, trollop in Desperately Seeking Susan more than, like, the British lady, you know, from, like, the 2000s.
Right.
You know? I mean, I always said I felt like in Meet the Fockers, Barbara was, like, just would have given anything to be Blythe Danner's part instead.
Totally. That's so funny. I mean, and you know, casting Blythe Danner in Prince of Tides as... Nick Nolte's wife, is that who she plays, right?
Yeah.
Well, and if you listen to Barbara's interview on Alec Baldwin's podcast, which is just a treasure trove, you know, he talks about being up for that role, and she was like, and not getting it, and losing it to Nick Nolte, and he's, you know, jokingly bitter about it, and she's like, well, we really needed someone who looked a little more all-American for that role, you know?
The highest compliment Barbara Streisand
totally,
knows that
totally,
again.
But like, the fact, like, Barbara...
No, all-American, like, Nick Nolte, Ryan O'Neal, Robert Redford, James Brolin.
Totally.
You know the type.
But the fact that Barbara directed Prince of... She directed Yentl, of course, but then she directed Prince of Tides, which is just, like, the complete opposite about, like, this, like, southern, white southern family, you know? It's so fascinating to
At
me.
At least she plays... Like Dr. Lowenstein. I love Prince of Tides.
I do too. That's
I wouldn't have a word said against Prince of Tides.
No.
But as much as I love Prince of Tides, as much as I love Funny Girl, I hate The Mirror Has Two Faces.
The Mirror Has Two Faces is unwatchable. I mean, I liked it when I was younger because I like didn't know anything. But like we watched it, I think, in Fire Island last summer, and I was like, this is actually badly directed.
That movie is so bad.
It's really phoned in. But Prince of Tides, I think, is a masterpiece. I mean, I would say it's, after Funny Girl and What's Up, Doc, it's maybe my favorite Barbara film.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, even before The Way We Were, because, I mean, The Way We Were has I mean, she's so wonderful in it, but as a film, it has so many issues.
Yeah, aren't you forgetting? Doesn't she have some great movie from the early 70s also?
Owl and the Pussycat. Up the Sandbox. I've never seen Up the Sandbox, but that's like one of her favorites.
The one that's like really bad, and it's not even her fault. It's just like a shitty movie from the 70s. I don't know how she wound up in it.
For Pete's sake.
Up All Night.
Oh, yeah. Is that the one with James Caan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or is it
Gene Hackman?
Gene Hackman.
Yeah, maybe it is Gene. It's the one with, she has that like blonde wig.
Oh, it's so bad.
I've heard that. There's a big chapter on some.
It's like weird to think about an era
recently
when Barbara Streisand was doing big movies, but the ones better actresses passed on.
Yeah. Ethan Mordden, the On Streisand book he wrote, there's a really good section on Up All Night in that
That's
book.
That's On Streisand, an opinionated guy.
An opinionated guy, yeah.
It's great. Highly recommended.
But
at least to keep us busy for the time being until Dublin Zoetrope writes his Dublin Zoetome on Barbara.
Totally, totally. We need that Dublin Zoetome. But then, you know,
he'll probably start with Glenn Close.
Let's be honest. But the thing is, I think we actually touch on this a little bit with our interview with Michael R. Jackson. It's this idea that people who are creating really good art, you know, in the beginning of their career, and they were collaborating with people, and you know, they were doing it with a hunger and not just to, you know, continue their career. When they then have unlimited resources and wealth, and just they're surrounded by a bunch of yes men, it really does become detrimental to the work, you know, because it's like there's no, the hunger's not there because it's, you know, they don't need it to survive and they don't, you know, they're not trying to prove themselves anymore. But also, they kind of don't have, they're not held accountable in a certain way that they would be. As, like, a youngster starting out, you know?
Like, I have to deal with, like, you mouthing off to me, and it makes me a better artist. But somebody, if I could afford to just, like, replace you with somebody that would kiss my ass, my work would suffer.
Right. Well, I'm sure you could find, there's an app for that, I'm sure.
I'm banned.
What else could we say about Babs? About Barbara?
I mean, about Yentl.
About Yentl, yeah.
It's interesting that she went for the same ending as it's the same ending as Fiddler on the Roof, but it's shot like the Don't Rain on My Parade
it's
scene.
So in Don't Rain on My Parade. Barbara on Boats is like a whole thing.
Yeah.
Something funny that I just thought of.
Yeah.
This is like so crazy. When I was little, I don't know if someone told me this or if I made it up in my mind, but before I'd ever seen Yentl.
Oh, the other Barbara Streisand movie that I really love is Hello, Dolly.
And see, I don't love that one. But
when was the last time you
watched rewatch
it?
I watched it in summer 2012 when I was really starting to remember
phase. That's a long time ago.
But I remember thinking, like, even though I didn't really know Dolly at the time, I remember thinking, like, she's not really right for this. But I need to rewatch it just because I think it's, you know, again, a beautifully shot, beautifully
I mean, it's not a great film at all, but it's a very enjoyable, like, it is.
Well, now that I'm, like, one, like, really deep in my Dolly years, I need to revisit it.
Totally.
But, so what I was saying is,
you need to come back to the lights of 14th Street.
100%. But when I was little, I thought, for some reason,
Yentl. I wonder if that Rufus Wainwright lyric is a Hello Dolly reference.
Which one?
What's the song?
14th Street,
I'm going back to 14th
Street. To 14th Street, so I won't hurry. And I'll learn how to beg, not just borrow. And there'll be rainbows. Maybe. I don't know, though.
He did sing a Jerry Herman song.
That's
when
true.
We saw him
it was like a weird one. It was
Dear World.
Dear World. Oh, yeah. Title song. Anyway, when I was little, I thought Yentl was the sequel to Fiddler on the Roof.
It is. Well, no, Rags is the sequel to Fiddler on the Roof.
Is it really?
No, but I mean, it could be.
Yeah.
Yentl.
I mean, but yeah, I mean,
Yentl takes place like during Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah, but it's like not the same characters. You know, thought it was literally
it's not a sequel.
I thought it was literally a sequel.
Both anti-Semitic and
I know it's problematic.
You've got to be taught.
Careful the thing. Oh, my least favorite Barbara song of all time. Children will listen.
Although I do like when Ruthie Henschel does Barbara's arrangement.
Ruthie Henschel, is that how you pronounce it? Ruthie Henschel?
How do you say it?
Ruthie Henschel?
No, I think it's Ruthie Henschel.
Oh, I thought you were making a joke.
Like, no, that's not a joke. Ruthie Henschel's Chauvin. Not a joke.
I love Ruthie Henschel. I think she's wonderful. Her Fontaine is amazing.
Oh, there we go.
I know, we won't open
up. She doesn't have enough other parts.
We won't open up this can of worms.
She's my second favorite Fontaine. Third.
Who's your second?
Randy Raff. She's a dear friend.
Dear friend. She was my Fontaine growing up.
It's the original Broadway cast. So, yeah. You know, pretty solid.
And I like her Fontaine because she really,
she's like, what's a mix?
It's very raw. Yeah, and what's a mix? 100%. I don't like a mixy Fontaine.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see Barbara's Fontaine.
Would you settle for her On My Own?
I don't really need that. She never did
that. Yeah.
When?
I have it.
But it's not like, on an album.
Yeah, it's like on that like unreleased or whatever. Release me.
Yeah, release me from the album's point of view. Release Me, My Story by Sammy Streisand.
On that note.
On that note. But she did sing I Dreamed a Dream.
No.
Really?
Yes. What are you, like Patti LuPone? When Barbara Streisand recorded Don't Cry For Me Argentina and Stole My Thunder.
That seems like a missed opportunity, her Barbara not singing I Dreamed a Dream.
I mean, you can see her wanting On My Own more. In 1986, you know?
Sure. Yeah, and, well...
And Neil Diamond did I Dreamed a Dream, so she was like, well, she could have gotten in for the duet.
I mean, she sang every other song, that like, a hit song in that time. Like, it's really crazy she didn't... I mean, she sang, like, you know, Memory, All I Ask of You.
Well, Memory was a huge hit for her that was, like, a big deal before she even did the Broadway album. All I Ask of You was, like, a random track. I'm sure she doesn't remember she even recorded from, like, a random album.
Yeah, she hears it on the radio, she's like, who's this? They're wonderful. anyway, yeah, on that note, after just completely shitting all over Yentl, let's talk about it too with Charles Bush.
Well, we are guerrilla quarantine recording here, kamikaze style, in the fabulous West Village home of the divine Charles Bush.
Lovely having you here.
Quite the spot.
I've been so alone. You're all the first people I've spoken to in several days.
Well, we want everything. How are you?
I'm doing fine. But you're really... My sequestered life is terribly different from my regular life.
That's the key.
Yes. No, because I rarely leave, you know, the Bohemian Quarter here.
Why would you? I mean, this is... anyone that hasn't read the New York Times piece on this fabulous apartment with the great photos, I mean, it's
a, is it still available?
It must be.
I thought it was, like, taken off their archives since 1865.
No, maybe you have to... maybe you have to be a subscriber, but in this era, we should all support the New York Times.
Yes.
The real news. Well, it is medicine for the soul to talk to you.
Totally.
In these trying times.
I know. I think this is the first time, Ben, that you've actually been here, except at, you know, when at my Christmas
Your
party.
Legendary Christmas parties, where it's like elbow to elbow. Hopefully we'll be far past the plague by the time Christmas comes around, because it would not be safe. There's no way to keep
really?
3 inches between, you know. There's probably a joke in there somewhere about 6 inches. I don't know.
Six inches.
You know.
We'll leave it be.
Yes. Thank you. I've now gone too lowbrow for Charles Bush. You can turn off the mic. Well, as I told you, I was so blown away by The Confession of Lily Dare. I mean, in the lifetime of being blown away by your work, I think it was still a high.
It was really my favorite... certainly my favorite role that I've ever played. Mm. Yeah, I just loved it. It was kind of a charmed experience. I mean, everybody involved, you know, the cast was great. They're all friends of mine. But the crew, the management, everything was, everybody was nice. There wasn't like one you know, sour pickle, except maybe me.
As is your right.
Yeah, yeah. Other than that, yeah, no, it was just great. And, you know, it was at the Cherry Lane Theater, which is about a 6-minute walk from my apartment, so it doesn't get better than that.
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I had very little to complain about. It made it difficult for me.
Yeah. But I found something.
You know, always
the
gotta
student
look
matinees they forced me to do. Ooh, stuck in my craw.
Well, it's maybe because of the epicness of that story, you kind of got to do a little bit of everything from the bag of tricks. You know, really, I got to see so many of your fortes, the different playing the innocent to the, you know, embittered older diva and her whole, you know, scrappy
journey. Yeah, because I kind of played 5 different characters.
Yeah,
in a way, and that was part of the whole point of it. In a way, I just always loved movies where the actress ages and goes from girlhood to cronedom.
Yeah,
I just love those movies so much, and I always wanted to play that kind of part. And you know, and over the years, I've come up with different scenarios to enable me to do that, which we never did. Oh, one was going to be kind of a How the West Was Won sort of story, where I was a young, feisty young Irish servant girl who, you know, gets in a covered wagon and helps settle this grand country of ours. You know? And I think Julie Halston was going to be a beaver trapper from the Adirondacks.
Oh my God. Isn't that her actual background?
Amazing.
But that never happened. I have some outlines for about a dozen of these plays we never did. But this one, that I think it began with the idea that I wanted to play a part where I aged a lot. And I kind of thought at 65, if I was going to play a girl of 16, I better hurry up. So that's why I did it. But yeah, it was cool that you know, because each scene, she started off as a sort of Gigi and then became Dietrich, like cabaret entertainer, and then
that Kurt Weill parody song was so brilliant.
Wasn't that good? Tom Judson wrote that.
Tom Judson, your brilliant collaborator, musical director. Who also, I have to give a shout out because I'm a big patron of his work for Tom's Trendy Tees.
Of course,
many talents. I love Tom's Trendy Tees. You can get your Alexis Smith Platinum T-shirt, Mac and Mabel, all the Broadway flops you didn't know you needed.
It's so stylish. Yeah.
Yes,
and now he has the Ann Magnuson collection.
I gotta go look.
She's an old friend of his, and I guess
they
came up with over a course of a weekend another dozen cool T-shirts with her imprint.
Oh, well, I know what I'm getting everybody for Christmas. So now we talked to you about what your broken record would be, the album that you were obsessed with, and we were tickled, I mean, really, guffawing,
so
that the album that you said immediately...
Of
all the records...
in the world.
...was Yentl.
And
it all began.
Yes, please.
The day I found.
Each step I take, Papa, I've a voice now. Each page I turn, Papa, I've a choice now. Each mile I travel only means the more I have to go. What's wrong with wanting more? If you can.
Yeah, well, I love that movie. I think it was a hit, and it's not like it was some maligned thing. And yet, in a way, I think it is a bit forgotten or dismissed, maybe just a bit. Mm. And I thought it was a wonderful movie and a fantastic score. Man, Michel Legrand. I mean, it's so brilliant. And then the Bergmans wrote the lyrics. Mm-hmm. Are so graceful. And yeah, and I used to. I was never really a big record buyer, but
movies were always your thing.
I just never really listened to music that much.
Yeah,
but occasionally I would buy a record, and
it's very Barbara of you. She doesn't listen to music either.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I did buy a number of her records.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but
I don't think anyone's fun.
Well, no, because she recorded
them.
So much.
Yeah.
Yeah, my God. I mean, in the 70s, I mean, between the 60s and 70s, I mean, there's really not really a standard that she didn't record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I did a cabaret show of 70s music, and I didn't intend it to be that way, but half the songs she'd recorded at some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Audra McDonald said, "You can't swing a dead cat without hitting a song Barbara Streisand recorded."
Yeah, it really is so true. She recorded so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Yentl, she's an incredible voice.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's kind of with maybe a vocal peak of hers.
Yes.
What year is that? Like 82 or something like that?
84, I think. Same year as Vampire Lesbians of Sodom.
Was it that late, you think?
Maybe it was 83, but...
It's around there, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, she was at a real kind of vocal peak, and I guess it was such a passionate project of hers. Mm-hmm. I remember, I think, I went to see... maybe it was like the first time she came back to singing in public at Madison
Square Garden. In 93,
I saw that. I was way up in top tier of Madison Square Garden.
Just where she wants you.
I was just watching the video screens.
And read along with the banter.
The banter, yeah. So now I really couldn't voice this tiny little figure who seemed very uncomfortable at that point.
It's so wonderful to be here with it. Gay games.
but I felt that she seemed so, it's always easy to, project on people, but it seemed like she was very uncomfortable performing and it wasn't really a stage creature at this point anymore.
Wish I was back on the set.
And it was kind of just she was just had her arms holding herself. And yet I found that when she did the Yentl medley, that was the only time I felt that the performance I saw that she really was somehow emotionally connected.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And you could I felt that somehow this is something that was so important to her, and it still held such resonance that it all of a sudden really, that was the one time when I saw it that she just really came alive, and it was awfully exciting when she was singing with against the screens of her her own image, and it was cool. But I love all the songs in that. I have this new cabaret act that's eventually I'll play since all the dates are canceled. But if Tom and I ever do it, we're actually doing the song from Yentl. I never get the title right, but is it No Matter What Happens?
No Matter What Happens.
Yeah.
I've wandered the shadows. I don't anymore. No matter what happens, I won't.
Because I related to it. I with my cabaret act, I started off doing it in drag.
Yeah.
And I started doing this latest foray into cabaret. It's been about 8 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'd had different times in my career. First in the late 70s and then the early 90s where I did cabaret work. Never quite with the intensity of focus as this
I remember in Lost Horrors of Lost Atlantis.
Yeah.
Your wonderful novel that's a thinly veiled memoir of your early years as a playwright and star in the East Village drag theater scene of the 80s. Yeah. There was some I remember relating very much, and there was some the way that the character, the lead, the narrator of the story, talks about himself. He's like, I can sing. And I don't remember exactly how you phrase it, but he has like a funny chip on his shoulder about it.
Well, I've sung in shows of mine, but never that seriously. When I was doing cabaret, my first cabaret career in the late 70s, there was no music at all. They were just monologues.
Oh.
And
where did you do that, though?
At the Duplex.
At the Duplex. The old On Grove, the old
Duplex. Yeah, the original Duplex, yeah. And then my second cabaret career in the early 90s, when I worked with Dick Gallagher.
Oh, the great Dick Gallagher.
Yeah, so missed and beloved. And I felt at that time that my audience really be disappointed if I was not in drag, and I did mostly special material. I thought, oh, maybe I could do one, maybe two, but really just one ballad. Mm. It's all they, whoever they is.
Well, you had a big audience, to be fair.
But allow me. But allow me. And I didn't want to be, I don't know, I was self-conscious, but when I've seen other comic performers seeming indulgent by doing too much serious singing, and I was insecure about my actual singing.
Yeah.
You know. But then when I started...
Where did you do that one in the 90s?
At the ballroom I used to play a lot. Yeah, yeah. But the, so then when I started this again about 8 years ago, I started off still with that mindset that, oh, what will they expect?
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a dumb way of approaching anything, really. But I thought, okay, I need to be in drag. I had a friend of mine who said if you weren't in drag, it would be like going to Disneyland and finding out that Space Mountain was closed. It didn't help my confidence.
Ex-friend.
But then I don't know, I just started with Tom, you know, he's such a wonderful musician, and we just started doing more challenging material vocally, and I actually took some singing lessons, which does seem to help.
Who did you go to for a voice?
A friend of mine that I met on Facebook, John Tedeschi.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very helpful getting those diphthongs.
Yes.
Wonders of my diphthongs. So we started just doing so much more music. It's been a lovely thing. I've learned so much. And then finally, about 3 years ago, I just made this big decision to take out the drag, because I never really understood why I was in drag, other than that I was sort of known for this thing. But
you did have that one cabaret character.
I did Miriam Passman. Yeah. I used to do. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it was I'd be introduced as Charles Bush, and then I would tell true stories about my life and sing Sondheim. So why was I in drag? But I did it, you know. And my sort of persona in my act was basically me, but just dialed up a bit.
Yeah.
Somehow slightly filtered through my grand dame character, but it's not that different from who I was.
Right.
So then finally, I just thought, I have to see what this is like.
Yeah.
And I booked myself for one night at Pangea in the East Village, which felt safe to me.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, I might not like this. I might find that I'm inhibited or self-conscious, and I didn't change the act at all. I just didn't do it with a red wig on, so it went great.
Yeah.
And but I was wearing just black pants, a black shirt, and then I thought, am I so lacking in imagination in this day and age that I have to be the cater waiter at a memorial service? So I had this. Paisley suit made that was kind of the thin territory where Bruno Mars meets Judy at the Palace.
Yes, it's very Judy at the Palace.
Very, absolutely. Yeah, and then he was a famous fashion designer and illustrator in the 70s, Michael Volbrocht, and he passed away about a year ago. And he was on Facebook. I just kind of met him on somebody else's thread, and you know, but he had made a big impression on me. Oh, he had done all these incredible illustrations of Elizabeth Taylor and Bette Davis and book covers, and he was a fashion designer, and he was really big in the 60s and 70s, and then retired. So we started chatting on Facebook and became rather friendly. I never met him. He lived in Florida.
Yeah.
And so when I got out of drag, I asked, first messaged him and asked his advice on getting this suit made, and he said, well, you just take this young man who's the designer, he said, take him to Gucci and try on the most fabulous expensive suit that you love and that fits you perfectly, and take many pictures and have him base it on that. And that's what we did. So this retired guru became, you know, helped me, and then I posted a picture of me wearing this suit. And Michael Volbrock wrote, "What's your phone number?" And so I gave him my phone number, and he called up, and he was kind of an irascible, guy. Said, "You look terrible." I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa." He goes, you need to fill it. You can't just wear that suit. You need to fill in the whole top, where is it, by the neck with fabulous beads, barbaric beads, violent beads, beads." And I said, "Well, but the point is that I'm not in drag." He said, "Doesn't matter." And so hung up. So I get off the phone. I'm thinking, "Oh, that old man, he doesn't know." Half hour later, I'm on 38th Street buying all these beads, violent beads.
Oh, we need to see before and after.
And so I filled it all in with these beads. It looked incredible. And so he, I wrote him. I said, "What do you think?" He said, "Perfect." And then he, I think he died about a month later.
Well, he finished his work.
I was kind of his last customer and last client. Mm. Yeah. So that was kind of special.
Oh, no, that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, speaking of meeting fabulous people in Facebook comments, I have been obsessing about MAME and anti-MAME lately. I mean, I always loved it.
You know, why did you bring that up? It sounded like you'd never heard of MAME before or something.
Well, I'd seen the movie anti-MAME a bunch of times growing up, although probably not that... Well, no, that's not even true. I maybe watched it a year ago because I bought it on Apple. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I knew the musical and I'd seen the movie, but I'd never seen it on stage. And I recently read the novel for the first time and just went, head first and read the sequel. And now I'm reading all the Patrick Dennis stuff. And
what about Little... Have you seen the...
I'm reading Little Me right now. And,
kind of his masterpiece.
The musical did not...
Oh, terrible.
I only ever knew Little Me through the musical.
So what happens when straight people take gay subject matter filter through their
cultural appropriation.
That's true cultural appropriation. Totally.
But the person that, thanks to you commenting on my Facebook thread that I met just this morning, was Michael Tanner, Patrick Dennis's son.
Oh, he's a wonderful man.
He's wonderful.
Head of Bellevue. He's like the
amazing
doctor of Bellevue.
Good to know.
I bet he's busy.
You should see his apartment. It's
not the famous one on where Patrick Dennis.
I can't remember where they live. But what's cool is it's this big Upper West Side apartment. But he has this artist friend who's a trempe l'oeil painter. Just paint every wall is not real. It's all like fake bookcases and fake things. You feel like you're in a pop-up book. It's the most gorgeous.
Oh, amazing.
It's like a palace, but nothing is real. It's really cool.
I love that.
And he and his sister Betsy were very helpful to me. I got to know them because my ex-partner Eric Myers
wrote the wonderful
biography
about
their
that
father
I read also, yes.
Uncle Maine, Patrick Dennis. And so we got to, during the 2 years that Eric researched the book, we got to know everybody in his circle, in Patrick Dennis's circle, including his children. Mm-hmm. And then a number of years later, I wanted to do a summer stock tour of anti-MAME. And the Lawrence and Lee Estates, the two authors
that wrote
the play adaptation.
And later the
musical. Yeah.
Inherit the Wind.
Their estates just said no, that a man, they weren't familiar with me, and it's just a man can't.
Had you already done the one night?
I'd done the benefits, and I guess they weren't. They were, even though they were in Broadway houses, I guess they were done on the sly or something. That because it was a benefit, but somehow when we were going to do this commercial two city tour, we had to get the rights to the play.
Sure,
and they said absolutely not. So I went to ask Michael and his sister if they would put in a word to the estates, and they did. And so I was
and it made the difference. Amazing,
Because sometimes too does happen is the literary estates go down. They become so far removed from the original family. It's just a lawyer somewhere, and they're
sure.
They're just all they can do is. Apply the rules that were set originally, and that's it. And they're not theater people necessarily, so they don't know what kind of performer I am or what my history is.
Yeah.
So, I get it, kind of.
Sure, but it's a shame. I mean, well, it's wonderful that this broke through. Because, I mean, that is what keeps the work alive. You know,
what's really too bad is the Claire Booth Luce estate with the women, the play The Women. When she was alive, and that was, you know, she died many years ago.
Yeah.
I guess she absolutely stipulated that no men could play this, do this.
Wow.
Yeah, but, you know, the play isn't done that often. If it's got a cast of 40.
Yeah.
And it is a pity because I think they could be making a lot of money if they opened it up. And I've done it numerous times as one night events, but we've always kind of skipped town by the time the estate finds out about it. Oh, they did it again! You know, it's terrible. Right, but I played the Norma Shearer part.
I love that number
of times in different cities. I've done it with all guys. Mm. I've done it with partly drag people and biological women. Then I've done a number of times with where I'm the only person in drag, and it's all women. Last time was incredible. It was in Palm Springs, and it was a benefit for a fundraiser for a theater out there in Palm Springs, mm-hmm. Coyote Theater, is that what it's called? And anyway, it was this crazy cast. You know, I played Mary Haynes, the Norma Shearer part, but it was Lucy Arnaz, Lorna Luft,
oh my God,
Florence Henderson, Harry Gilpin, Mo Gaffney, Carol Cook, Kay Ballard.
Carol, you had me at Carol.
It was the most crazy. And it goes, now we go back to MAME again because my late manager, Jeff Melnick, who lived at Palm Springs, came up with this idea to raise more money for this theater company, mm-hmm. to get these fabsy, wealthy society ladies out there in Palm Springs, put them in small parts in the cast. Mm. And then they would sell the expensive tickets. Mm. And it really worked. These women, you know, billionaires.
Yeah.
They sold the $1,000 tickets and they did their job. However, they had to be in the play. And we cast them in these small parts as maids.
These maids.
And it was just like Auntie Mame, except that I was Vera. Yes. These women would spend, you know, 2 hours of the show primping and fixing their jewelry and everything.
Oh my God.
And then they'd come out on stage. We rehearse them, and suddenly wanted to do something with the role. And, you know, they walk in with an accent.
Make a choice.
And they're all late. It really was exactly Mame. It was so funny. I remember there was this one elegant woman, and I saw her backstage, and she was in this elaborate black and white maid's uniform and little cap. And I said, "Where did you get that fabulous maid's uniform?" "From my maid." It was crazy. It was just crazy. Oh, there are two funny stories from that production. One was that they had Carl Andrews, who directs most of the plays, he directed this
benefit. Mm-hmm.
And anyway, they found a little 10-year-old girl, local little girl, to play the daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, and she has a dramatic monologue where she's makes a prayer and says that her parents won't get divorced. Mm-hmm. Well, this little girl, I don't know who she was, but she was like a pocket streep. And then tears coming down her face. And Carl and I were just so fascinated. So we made her do it 8 times in rehearsal. Yeah. And each time the tear came down. It really was incredible. And so Lucy Arnaz, you know, was observing this and sauntered over and said to the little girl, "Kid, if you're going to some dark place, it's not worth it." and then the other story was, and Michelle Lee was in it too. Mm. I mean, everybody was in it. And so anyway, I was sharing this dressing room with Lorna Luft, Michelle Lee, and Lucy Arnaz.
Oh, God.
This dressing room. So I was wearing this rather chic, somewhat form-fitting little black cocktail dress for the reading. And we were in like the one tech rehearsal we got something, and so we're all in the dressing room. Michelle is all fit to be tied, and she says, "I just think it's really unfair that Charles is mic'd and we're not." I said, "I'm not mic'd. What are you talking about?" She says, "You're mic'd." I said, "I'm not mic'd." She says, "Your body mic'd." I said, "I'm not." She says, "I can see the mic pack," and she points to, you know, my crotch. I said, "Michelle, that's my dick." The mic pack.
Oh my god.
Actresses.
That's a good bit.
Actresses.
Rachelle Lee, indeed.
Actresses. You gotta love an actress.
Now, you just did that one night benefit of Alger's Wife with Michelle Lee, with you stepping into Linda's part and Linda as your mother, right?
That was one of the great nights of my life.
I'm so sad I missed that. I heard it was spectacular.
Well, it was Linda's idea. I guess she had been, you know, reading about how, you know, the Actors Fund had been doing a number of these reunion shows.
Yeah.
Like they're playing our song, and and it was 20 years since Alger's Wife. So it was her idea, and she thought that it would be great to have the original cast back, except that, you know, the Cheryl Bernheim played the mother. You know, it was very old and died a number of years ago. So Linda
thought she was so hilarious.
Oh, she was great. So Linda thought she'd like that she should play the mother and that I should play Linda's part. And it really was not a role that I ever wanted to play or thought of playing. It didn't seem, wasn't exactly my style, and it's more naturalistic. And, you know, it was never a dream of mine at all.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, you know, and I had said to her, I said, Linda, I mean, because Linda basically looks exactly the same as she did 20 years ago.
Yes.
And, you know, and at the height of her powers. And so, you know, I said, you sure you don't want to just play the part? And she said, no, no, no. And so we did it, and Lynn Meadow, the original director, put it together, and we did it at the Manhattan Theater Club's Broadway house, the Friedman.
Yes.
And, Michelle and Tony Roberts and Neil Kumar played the doorman. They all came back, and it was thrilling. And to act with all of them, but, you know, Linda, I just kind of worship her acting talent.
Totally.
And it's the way she's so really in the moment, and it used to frustrate me sometimes when I would, during the original production, and I would come back and see it, and that, you know, there were line readings of hers that I just loved, and then they would not be there, but then there'd be something else, some other new thing that was fascinating.
Right.
It's just, you know, what she's like.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting, too. So when we did it, you know, I was kind of using her the template of her performance, because first of all, that's the way it was written, and it was written for her. And but there were a couple lines, there were just line readings of hers that I just loved so much that I duplicated. And if I ever did it again, probably won't, but if I did, I would change it, because there's just a couple line readings that were just so her, and based on this kind of vocal mechanism
Linda
she has.
She
gets a nasal sort of thing, you know, and I don't have it. And so there's a couple lines of, I wish I hadn't done that. It was okay, but it just, that belongs to her.
Mm.
Yeah, but it was an incredible night.
I mean, that play is so seminal for you. I mean, I remember being, I had just moved to New York, and I was assisting Lonnie Price on a class act at the Theater Club, and we were rehearsing the same time that you guys were rehearsing.
Was Nancy Anderson in that?
Yes, with beautiful Nancy Anderson. Yeah. That's when I first met Nancy.
Okay.
But I remember seeing you in the lobby a lot of the Manhattan Theater Club Studios on 43rd Street. You know, and I'd only seen you, like, on stage, or I don't know. I feel like you did a lot of sort of like the Easter bonnet kind of stuff, like always in drag, you know,
always.
But just be, and Charles Bush, you know, and you would be the MC or whatever, you know.
I was so insecure that.
And then there was this
myself.
Kind of just, you know, I mean, I don't want to say butch, but you know.
You can say that. It's been a problem.
But I mean, you know, you didn't look like a drag queen. You looked like, just this, you looked like a Broadway playwright, you know. Standing next to me at the urinal, you know, and
that was mic pack.
But I remember thinking what breakthrough this was, that you know you'd been this, you know, more than a cult figure, but I mean really this, you know, fringe, you know, counterculture thing,
right.
And here you were with this Broadway, you know, I mean, Linda Lavin and Michelle Lee, you know, and Robert Klein, you know, just this Broadway.
Tony Roberts.
And Robert Klein replaced him. Was that the?
Richard Kind. Same idea.
everybody Jewish over 50.
Yeah.
But speaking of which, we were talking about it, not to get off that topic, but has there ever talk of a movie version with Barbara?
Yeah, so it's dragged on for 20 years.
Really?
I just guessed that. It just seems so perfect.
Yeah, it's supposed to be Bette Midler.
Mm. But that too.
But then, I don't know, then Bette had this idea that she was more right, actually, for Michelle's
part. I'm sure she did. So wouldn't they all? So
but the other part's really the lead, you know? Mm. And so she...
Yeah, but that doesn't make her more right for it.
Yeah, so she thought she was actually more right. So she personally called Barbara and got her the script. And
oh,
then,
my God.
And then Barbara said she really liked it, but she didn't want to do it.
Oh, that Bette was thinking they would both do
that
it?
That they would be able to do it together.
Oh, wow. Oh, kind of now cool. I'm listening.
Yeah. So I don't know. Wow. It's not a dead thing, but I don't think with either of them.
Yeah. Well, listen, the actresses just keep getting older. If you wait long enough, it could be your little pocket street from Palm Springs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I'm surprised Elle Fanning has something off
yeah,
of the role.
Exactly. Yeah. But so, okay, so
but
what...
Where were we?
Going back to that sort of transition, you know, where you, from being this downtown, you know...
Yeah, it was kind of... It was a strange period for me. I mean, on one hand, yeah... Yeah, it certainly was a surprise to me as well as everybody that I was going to have this big Broadway comedy. But it sort of annoyed me just a little bit that, you know, but I'm ambivalent about what I eat for breakfast. I'm incapable of just expressing pure joy. There's always something I can find, you know, to rub me the wrong way. It's just, or analyze.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it bugged me a little bit that this whole kind of narrative about me that season was that this East Village drag queen, you know, had written a mainstream Neil Simon type play, and it bugged me because number one, over the past 15 years or previous, you know, all my plays were done by reputable nonprofit theaters.
Yeah.
That all moved commercially.
Yeah.
Yes, it was off Broadway, but it was, you know, and it seemed to.
And
to
we're
diminish.
Being done all over the country
yeah,
and the world.
All over, and just a few years, just a couple of years before that, I'd written a Jewish comedy called You Should Be So Lucky, where I played a role that ran off Broadway, and you know, with a similar milieu. So it just. You know, everything becomes sort of simplified.
Yeah.
To create a narrative.
Yeah.
You know, it just to make things easier.
Sure.
And it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
That's just, you just accept that. But it did kind of, did sort of bug me. But what finally cured me of that was one night I was just lying here watching, I think, Survivor. And it was about 8:30. And I thought, oh, gee, Linda's right in the middle of Act One and working so hard. And I think I just made about... $15,000. My 10% of the gross.
Yes!
That cured me of anything that ailed me as far as you know, just mainstream or downtown.
Yes.
But I do think, I really do have this theory that it's all about the side, whether something is downtown or fringe or mainstream, it's the size of the publicity budget.
Yes.
You know, you can have the most bizarre Ivo van Hove deconstructed, you know, show, and if you have taxi ads and subway posters and a TV commercial, then you're mainstream.
Yeah,
right.
You know, otherwise, you're downtown.
Mm. Now, I heard you say just a little earlier that you had written Allergist's Wife for Linda Lavin.
Ish. You know, I had started, I think just to kind of put it in a succinct way, I had written the book to one of my numerous failed musicals, to play a show called The Green Heart.
Oh, yes, with Rusty McGee.
Yeah, with Rusty. Mm-hmm. And we had done that through Manhattan Theater Club.
Yeah.
At the Variety Arts Theater.
Did Lynn Meadow direct that?
No, but she produced it. Ken Elliott, who's directed most of my earlier plays, directed that. So anyway, I hit it off with Lynn, and she... after that play, the show opened, she said, oh, I'd love to do your next play. I'll produce it, whatever you come up with. Jeez. Mm. So, you know, I knew they were kind of square over there at Manhattan Theater Club for subscribers, so Vampire Lesbians Part 2 may not be the ticket. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I had this character, Miriam Passman, of this, you know, raging Upper West Side lady that I'd done in my solo shows. And I thought, oh, that'd be a great... I always wanted to write a play with that character.
Mm.
So I thought, oh, this is the perfect opportunity, because she basically is the Manhattan Theater Club subscriber.
Yeah.
You know, right. So I began working on it, figuring it out. And I certainly knew of Linda Lavin, you know, obviously. But I went to see her in this show... Death Defying Acts. There were three.
Oh,
acts.
Yes. Was it Woody Allen?
Wayne May.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was there... Not was Paul there? Rudnick.
No. Anyway, I saw it, and then I thought, oh, well, she's just the perfect actress to play this character.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was still writing it, so I just had her completely in mind at that. Maybe not at the very beginning, but midway through. And wrote it really fairly quickly. And then showed it to Lynn Meadow and said, well, let's do a reading right away. And who's your fantasy casting for Marjorie? And I saw Linda Lavin, and we got her, and we did this reading. And it just was, I've never seen anything like this before, because I know for a fact that Linda didn't even glance at that script before. she opened it. There's no rehearsal. It was just... flawless. I've never seen anything like this. I mean, she gave this performance that really was no different from what she did on Broadway.
Mm.
You know, in some ways, there were, you know, line readings she did at that reading that she would never do again, just out of sheer perversity. Lynn and I were just so ecstatic. So you'll do the play? Will you do it? Down. She kept us dangling for 9 months.
Oh my God.
And we did readings with other actresses and just wasn't quite right. And then finally I kind of stalked her, basically, is what I did, you know, and just broke her down, and she did it. And it was this incredible success for us. And she was nominated for a Tony, and
right.
And I was also. And, you know, it ran 2 years on Broadway and big national tour. I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, it was a fabulous thing that.
It's almost the kind of thing they talk about that we don't see anymore, these, you know, commercial Broadway comedies.
I don't think they really have them anymore, do they? I remember being at some Manhattan Theater Club event, and I was with Michelle, and Barry Grove, who's the managing director, made a speech and said something about, was talking about Manhattan Theater Club, and the Tale of the Allergist's Wife, which is the longest running comedy of the past 25 years. So I whispered to Michelle, I said, because it's the only comedy in the past 25 years. She said, own it. they just don't really, you know, do comedies. I mean, I think humor mostly comes from the books to musicals nowadays.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was this play, I just saw Grand Horizons, that was with Jane Alexander.
But that's not on Broadway.
It was.
Well,
it was at the it used to be called the Helen Hayes, and now it's the second stage.
Oh, that's second stage. That doesn't really count. I guess it does count.
But I mean, but it closed. I mean, it didn't last. You know, and I liked it, but
it wasn't for a nonprofit run
on Broadway. Yeah.
Mm.
But was it a limited run?
I don't know. I'm not sure, but it closed sooner than it
should have.
Yeah,
I get you. It's really hard. Well, you know, the critics are pretty tough on comedies,
right.
Because, you know, the easy criticism is that it's sitcom.
Right, right.
You know, and you, that's the hard thing to get past.
And you never felt either inspired artistically or financially to want to make that magic happen again?
Oh, are you kidding? I'd do anything. Oh, my God. There were numerous times that I've written plays that I thought I were the type that could move, but, you know, there's a alchemy that has to be there.
Right.
Everything has to be set up, perfect series of circumstances for something to move to Broadway, which it's very expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I had a play called Olive and the Bitter Herbs that was produced a number of years ago with...
Is that another Jewish story?
Very Jewish,
yeah,
very
Bitter
Jewish.
Herbs is a Passover thing.
Yeah, I wrote it, and it was done for primary stages, and I thought, oh, this is, you know, this is my ticket back.
The Jews will come running.
And it was frustrating, too, because, you know, it got huge laughs, and it was these elderly subscribers at primary stages. I didn't think people lived that long. And they were just rocking with laughter, and because it was about them, you know.
Yeah,
and,
right.
But the reviews weren't that good. They weren't that good, and that one frustrated me because I thought, oh, there's an audience that just wants to would laugh so hard at this, and they were, but we can't give it to them.
Right.
So that was a disappointment, and not a number of them. Let's play the tribute artist we did a couple of years ago.
Oh, I love that one.
I had fantasies that could transfer, but the reviews weren't there, and. Mm. Or the interest, and that was a big disappointment. Now I've certainly it would be fabulous to have another play. To have a hit on Broadway is the most thrilling thing. I wish it for everyone.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It really was not a dream of mine. Oddly enough, I just was never thought like that. Like my goal is to get a play on Broadway. I really, you know, I had
You'd had so much success
I had
off Broadway.
Fine career as you know, doing what I was doing. I've never really operated that way.
Right.
You know, thought, oh, my dream is to have a sitcom, or I've just kind of gone from one adventure to another. And you know, perhaps I'd have a bigger career if I did have larger goals. I've just kind of, you know, been like a feather blowing through in the wind.
Well, another reading of it would be that in a world where there's very few functional systems in the theater industry that people can count on, you forged your own path and
did
things and forged original connections and something no one had ever done before.
Yeah, and I just have had a good time, you know, had so many dreams come true. Really.
Yeah.
Wonderful. But I never really thought of the big dream.
Yeah.
Right. Never did, even when I was so struggling. It's always, my dream is to do my act in San Francisco, and I worked really hard until I did that. Then my dream is to you know, do my show off Broadway. But I just never thought in terms of my dream is to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
But maybe it should have been, it's not how my mind works.
Yeah.
So suddenly there I was at the show on Broadway, and the day the marquee went up at the Barrymore Theater, it was pouring rain, and I just stood there like Stella Dallas. I watched it. I was in front, left, right. it just was incredible. It's the most amazing feeling, you know. And apart from the incredible, it gave me these huge checks each week, you know. But just it's just thrilling in the way people treat you and just the excitement of it all. And then being nominated for a Tony Award for Best Play, and I didn't have a chance to win. I mean, I was opposite such these like nobodies. What, Tom Stoppard?
Yeah.
Who is he?
Who's that?
August Wilson. Have you heard of him?
Never.
And this thing that opened, I don't know, Proof that won, you know.
Oh,
yeah. Have you heard of it?
No one talks about Proof anymore. They still talk about Allergist's Wife.
Well, anyway, so I knew I didn't have a chance of winning, but so I could just really have a good time going there.
Yeah.
Although, you know, that final 5 seconds.
The envelope.
Maybe they all cancel each other out. And I'm Marissa Tomei, and I'm there, you know. And I really honestly can never believe that when people win the Oscar and or Tony and they say that, oh, I had no speech prepared.
Right.
I mean, what have you been doing for the past 4 weeks?
Yeah.
What are you doing from the bathroom mirror for the past 4 weeks? Wouldn't you even ever consider just getting your thoughts together?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew I wasn't going to win, but I certainly, you know, stood in front of the bathroom mirror.
Right.
And I want to thank Lynn Meadow and, you know, and all the people who've been so kind to me. And,
yeah.
Yeah. No.
Oh, I love
that. But it was, it was, you know, a fabulous experience.
Mm.
Yeah, wish it could happen again. Probably won't.
And did you have, like, you know, I don't know, what are the cliches I dream about? Like, did Carol Channing want to take you to lunch?
Well, not like that, but I got an incredible letter from Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward.
Wow.
Who I'd never met or anything. Mm-hmm. Just this lovely, funny note from Paul Newman about just how much... they laughed so hard, and that the two of them never really laugh.
Yeah,
so they're just
I believe it.
They're not really laughers, and he said, "You made us. We laughed like we were two old whores." and Sondheim was very so kind. Oh, well, and he had been encouraging me encouraging to me a number of times, mm-hmm. you know, when I was before that.
Yeah.
But he saw the play at Manhattan Theater Club before we transferred, and
yeah.
and just loved it. And then when we were the week we were opening, it coincided with maybe it was I don't know, some big birthday of his or something. Mm-hmm. And Frank Rich did a cover story for the New York Times magazine.
Oh yeah, it was interview. His 70th.
Yeah, it was Sondheim yeah. 70, I guess it was. And in the piece, he says the funniest play I've ever seen was The Tale of the Allergist's Wife, and that was a great thing for us to go into yes. previews
yeah.
with that. And then after the play, he was so kind to me, and he sent me a telegram, a welcome to the big time, and just things that make you want to cry.
Yeah.
And then further than that, he invited Eric and I to a party at his townhouse, where I'd never been, and
Turtle Bay.
Yeah, and it was this incredible party, and you know, Dame Edna was there, and
yeah.
and every famous playwright, and it was just an extraordinary collection of people, and then he asked us to stay later, and we just had a wonderful time just chatting alone with him and
in the dungeon.
In the dungeon, how you're tied up, and then, we chatted marvelously. But anyway, I wrote him a thank you note saying you know really. Sometimes, you know, I kind of feel like the red leaf on the family tree, you know, in the theater, and you really made me feel part of, like I was part of Broadway. And he wrote me back a little note that said that was the point of the evening.
Aww.
Wasn't that something?
Yeah.
No, so stuff, yeah, stuff like that did happen. And, yeah, it was so wonderful.
Well, I wouldn't want to be a part of a Broadway that you weren't a major branch on.
Absolutely.
But you know, it's I've had such an odd career, you know, because I belong to all these different groups, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a playwright, an actor, and drag pioneer, cabaret entertainer, and you know, it is easy to feel like you're kind of a stranger in a strange land in all of them.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm easily touched when any one of those branches includes me.
Do you feel, speaking of, because drag has become such a big commercialized entertainment thing nowadays
right.
with RuPaul's Drag Race and all that, do you feel any kinship with those queens? Or, I mean, I'm sure you and RuPaul must have crossed paths in the 80s. And
yeah, barely,
much.
Barely. Really, you know, I've only really just sort of run into RuPaul a handful of times for 1 minute at a time. I don't know him.
Mm-hmm. Or what about just with the whole sort of movement that is out there now?
Well, yes, of course. You know, I think that, you know, I although it's so, most contemporary drag performers are so different from anything that
I
do. But yeah, but you know, we're kind of the same bloodline.
Yeah.
And there are some of them have been very, very kind and, you know, and, well, a number of them, you know, it turns out first thing, time they're ever in drag, we're in a local play of mine.
Yeah.
Bianca Del Rio. I said,
I didn't know that.
I think she wrote that, you know, like her first time she was in drag was in a Psycho Beach Party.
Amazing.
And that her first drag name was Marvel Ann that she took from, from that play.
Yeah.
And I think Sasha Velour said that I was big influence.
Jinx Monsoon.
Yeah, sure.
Have you seen any of the shows actually? Like, do you know, are you familiar with Peaches Christ, Josh Grinnell?
Yes, yes.
Because he does these great shows. They've been, I guess they're not going to be this summer, but the last few years they've been these summer runs in Provincetown.
I've never seen any of them.
And they're these great
parodies.
And I mean, I'm sure he would acknowledge that they're a huge, you know, what's the word?
I'm an influence.
Yes.
Yeah, well, certainly yes. And I think I would say it's safe to say that drag performers who have a theatrical bent and do plays, that I'm kind of the grandmother.
Well, that's the drag that I am drawn to, so yeah,
I would say so.
I like to see you reigning over it.
And it's one thing that's been very, very, very gratifying the last couple of years since I've been doing this cabaret thing, and it's for the first time I've actually toured. You know, we never toured any of my plays. We did sit-down productions of Vampire Lesbians in L.A. and Key West and Tokyo even, but I've never actually toured.
Yeah.
So with my cabaret show, I've been in about 40 cities and
wow.
four countries, and I do meet people afterwards who, younger performers who tell me that, oh, they were in, you know, production of one of my plays and came out to their parents because they were playing a part.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I mean, I wonder if, like, a little Charles Bush growing up now in the world where you already existed, knowing about your work and knowing about Tale of the Allergist's Wife on Broadway, might have dreamed of being a Broadway playwright. You know, maybe that didn't occur to you because you hadn't changed the world to make that happen yet.
Right,
you know?
Right.
I wouldn't hope so. I would
yeah.
think. Yeah, it was interesting. We did these with Lily Dare. We did 3 student matinees and...
Oh, I thought you were joking when you said
no.
that.
No.
It's too funny.
And, well, the first one was just hideous. I mean, these kids were so bored. I felt bad for them. I could see them in the audience just sitting there with their heads on each other's shoulders. And
yeah.
it was like they were watching TCM at their grandmother's house. I kept waiting. I felt like they were going to turn the channel and I was going to be like, you know, suddenly I was going to disappear. You know, they want to turn the channel. They can't, you know. But then we did this. The second one was a little livelier. And then the third one, I don't know who these kids were, but I think there may have been some LGBT kids. They were wild. They were screaming and carrying on. And it was very, very lively. And that did make me feel good. And I did think, well, maybe, you know, one of these 16-year-old kids or whatever someday might reflect on, yes, and I saw the legendary... Charles Bush, you know, when I in my youth, yes,
yeah.
he was very old at the time, but I remember, yes, you know, he was marvelous in his own way, yeah. No, that was cool.
That's awesome.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, putting you back in that fandom
totally
mind frame yourself,
and all my, you know, and really, and you know, we the last week that we did Lily Dare, we recorded it for Lincoln Center,
right?
Live,
oh,
wonderful. And they've been you know, they have this wonderful. It was a stage to film
right.
archive at Lincoln
yes.
Center
yeah.
mm-hmm. Library of Performing Arts, and then they record a lot of shows
yeah.
that
yeah.
you can go and watch. You
yeah.
know, and they've been incredible. Patrick Hoffman, who runs that department, has been extremely loyal to me, and they've pretty much taped every show that I've done. Since they started doing that, but then we used to tape our own shows in the early days, and,
oh, wow.
and you know, they're not the greatest quality,
sure,
it's,
right.
you know, home video, but I donated all
oh,
those.
Oh, that's
wow.
good to
so
know.
So they really do have a. I'm very well represented.
Oh,
the,
I want to go back and look at
yeah,
some of those from before my time.
All those
yeah,
things, yeah, and you know, it sounds a little you know rickety, but get the gist.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but this Lily Dare, I have you know they. Did a 2-camera, and I just saw a little glimpse of it when I was leaving the theater, and it's going to look really good.
Oh, that's great.
Wonderful.
I wish they would do something, you know, right now everyone's quarantined and social isolation and all that. I wish they would release some of these on streaming,
yeah.
you know, so we can
yeah.
watch them.
I just can't
from
do it.
Home.
It's all...
I know
when,
it's
when
like
you,
all these...
Well, when you do, when they tape things for Lincoln Center, you know, you fill out these forms.
Yes.
It's to protect, you know,
yeah,
the,
right.
people against... somebody making a profit, see,
yeah.
They swear they're it's only available to various people.
Yeah, you have to say your excuse for when you
something
you got
right,
it,
right,
student,
yeah.
a student.
Right.
It's pretty loose. I mean,
yes.
I think you just have to say,
yeah.
you know, I'm directing a production of
yeah.
Lily Dare.
Yeah. Right.
In the Bed-Stuy.
I've totally gone there and just bullshitted my way in.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
Well, it's putting you in the mind of a fan yourself. We play a game with all our guests,
okay.
which is a... listeners can't see that Charles grimaced when I said that.
I'm so bad. I'll go back to the Sondheim a little bit. I'll just tell you that, you know, when Eric and I first met him and he said something like, oh, you must... You said to me, you must know every movie ever made. And so he starts, you know, he's like a games
oh,
person.
Right, yeah.
So
he loves
games. Starts throwing out, like, you know, says, name me 4 movies starring Ida Lupino directed by Mitchell Eisen. And I mean, at that point, if he had said who played Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz,
yeah,
I would
say,
so my partner Eric, who really should be on Jeopardy, came out with the answers, and every time Sondheim would throw another one out, Eric would save it. He would say, "That's not fair." And I'm terrible.
It's not that kind of game. Right. It's more
pressure.
Whimsical.
Okay.
Do you know the game Marry, Fuck, Kill?
Oh yeah, yeah. Right.
So it's kind of a variation on that. It's called Dolly Concert Kill, and so we'll give you three performers, and you choose which of the three you would like to see as Dolly Levi in a Broadway revival of Hello Dolly, which one you would like to see in a peak career concert at their best, and which one, unfortunately, gets the axe. So I think we have to do Linda Lavin,
Bette Midler,
and
Barbara, Bette, and Linda.
Yeah.
So
you choose what you assign one Dolly Levi, one concert, and one gets the chair.
The chair.
Oh, I can't. You can't.
The easy chair.
Yes.
Wait. So who? Who? Which
so it's Linda.
Which one I want to see play Dolly?
Yeah.
Well, we've seen Bette do Dolly.
We've seen
Barbara, kind of.
And we've seen Barbara do Dolly.
Well, you could have her do it, you can direct. It can be done your way.
And Linda would have been an interesting Dolly.
She absolutely would.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Will say, of all the rounds of this game we've ever played, this is probably the most solid Dolly casting pool.
I know, but it would be very good as Dolly.
Totally.
So maybe it's who you most want to kill and who you least
want
to see in concert.
I don't want to kill any of them.
Well, that's just the default, you know.
Right.
Oh, this is a terrible. This is terrible.
We soft soap different people.
I'm involved with,
It can be Dolly Concert
three
Chill.
Of them.
So
three
one
of them
will get an all expenses paid vacation while the other two have to work in concert or as Dolly.
Well, I mean, Bette was a thrilling Dolly. That was so exciting.
Totally.
So you could say you've already seen her do it, or you could be just dying to see her do it more. And
yeah, I guess Bette does Dolly.
Bette is Dolly.
Yeah.
Totally.
So then concert, Linda or Barbara.
Well, I'd say Barbara.
Right.
And Linda, I'll write a new play for.
All right. She can read it on the beach.
Yeah.
We have a successful round.
Oh, brother.
Thank you, Charles. You're wonderful. I'm sorry that was painful for you. We're grateful.
Oh, horrible. Out. With your germs.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you so much, Charles. We love you.
Thanks for listening to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. For more episodes, visit Broadway World, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts do be.
This episode was edited by me, Daniel Nolan.
Thanks to Emmy-winning composer and lyricist Lance Horn for the Broken Records theme song.
Follow us both, Ben Rimmelauer and Daniel Nolan, on all y'all's socials.
That's Ben Rimmelauer. BenRimmelauer.
And that's Nolan with an E, not Nolan with an A.
Nolan with an A, isn't it? Ass.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.